the mound. Urban's got it. Nobody's covering second base.
I saw this right. Did Jeff Francoeur get this and throw it straight in the ground? He had a little stumble here. And that's the shortest throw you'll ever see. He just missed the cutoff, man.
Look at the phone. It's off the hook. Look at that slow. He's going to use the towel. This is a bad night.
Pitcher.
He's warming it up.
When the uniforms turned powder blue, the edge dropped off, and the sweet smell of success turned sour.
The Fanatic, his hot dog shooting gun, that's 98 miles an hour of compressed meat headed right at your noggin.
Welcome to a crisp new Dirty Inning.
Fresh, hello!
Fresh out of the oven. Ah, what a special time of year it is to be talking about baseball, Trev. No one is playing it on the Major League level. The Arizona Fall League is wrapping up. A labor dispute is on the horizon. The date for arbitration-eligible players to undergo that process was shifted from December 2nd to November 30th. The deadline, that's the word I was looking for. That was recently shifted, and players are finding teams. Aaron Loop is on the Angels. Wander Franco is staying with the Rays. It's what a time. What a special time.
Did you see the Phillies-related thing with Aaron Loop?
Mm-mm.
And the Angels? Oh, it's very funny. So it's not strictly Phillies related, but you'll see what I mean in a second. So this is the first pitching contract. Sorry, you hear the cats fighting in the background. Maybe
This is great because it serves as great background noise for discussion about baseball.
For fun facts.
Yeah, like labor. Like that's the sound of like the league and the players going at it.
Oh no.
Who is that? In that story, who just stopped? And, oh no!
What no!
It's Rob Manfred.
Yeah, he just said, "Oh no," because he's being attacked by lions. But Aaron Loop has been signed to a 2-year contract by the Angels, which is remarkable because the Angels have not signed a pitcher to a 2-year contract in about 10 years. Did you hear who the last person they signed to a 10-year or to a more than 1-year contract has been?
For a pitcher,
because obviously they've extended Trout and they signed Otani, so that, you know, hitters they've signed, but pitchers.
I'll guess Jared Weaver.
Ooh, great guess. Not correct, but really good guess. No, the Phillies connection here is that it was Joe Blanton in 2012.
Oh, right. There was a Phillies connection. Boy, I blew that. Wow, Joe Blanton just getting paid nonstop.
Good for him.
Buckets and buckets of ducats, that Joe Blanton. Man.
I've always been happy about Joe Blanton getting his. It's good to me.
He sure did. He's like one of your dad's softball teammates somehow made it into the major leagues and just got paid. And also won a World Series and also will be the last pitcher to have homered in the... Wait, no. Did someone else homer? Anyway, hit a home run in the World Series.
Anyway,
that story ends where I say it ends. Anyway, yeah, hey, we're going into the holiday weekend, and baseball is at its just most fun. It's that special time of year where John Heyman is basically the main character of the sport, and we just get to hear what Scott Boras thinks come out of John Heyman's magical mouth.
I can't wait till they do until someone remembers the Black Van tweet.
The temperatures are dropping.
You know the one.
The car is being packed to go to grandma's house. Trev, what neck of the woods will you be traveling to?
See, I'm staying close to home this time around. My dad's coming over to my house for Thanksgiving. We're actually getting I'm going to my mom's on Sunday for another Thanksgiving because my sister is at her new husband's. But on Thursday, on the actual day, we're getting stuff from a little place called Canal House in Milford, which is run by these James Beard Award winning chefs, and they're doing a takeout Thanksgiving that you can get. So
that's awesome.
Real fancy.
We did that last year. Yeah.
Oh, was it fun?
Oh yeah, yeah. It's very fun.
No.
I mean, you know, some Thanksgivings you're sitting around with your family, enjoying yourself, smelling stuff coming in from the kitchen. Others, you're getting the food
stuff.
You have to cook yourself, tossed to you from the back of a truck in the parking lot of a restaurant. It's
they throw it really hard.
equal amounts of magic. I mean, some of the better restaurants will just chuck a frozen turkey at your stomach from a moving train.
Get out of here, idiot! They
moving
yell.
At about the speed of the Braves World Series caravan as it just floored it through the Atlanta suburbs.
Oh, that was so magical.
It's just a good time to talk some ball, I feel. And on this podcast, you know, we always have Thanksgiving vibes here, in that we're not only giving thanks for the cornucopia of Philly's stories that spills out into our laps in each episode.
Blah!
That's the noise people make when they listen to this. But also, some episodes we take, you know, one dirty inning and just jam it inside another dirty inning, and then we just let those two cook for a while. And it just increases the flavor profile.
It's a dirty inning turducken, and we won't apologize for it.
Yeah, it's a good time. And hey, folks, the dirty inning episodes are available everywhere. And I know we did one, maybe it was even last year, called Turkey, Stuffy, and Pie.
Oh, that was a great episode.
And that was a great episode. We talked about two guys named Turkey, Stuffy McGinnis, and Pie Trainer. At different times that those people either played or destroyed the Phillies playing for another team. And yeah, so just Google that phrase and you'll find that Thanksgiving themed episode.
It'll certainly be the first hit this time of year. Turkey, stuffing and pie. Absolutely going to be the first hit on your
Stuffy and pie. So I feel like I like to use combinations of words that make it impossible for anything else to come up when you search for title episodes of but this year we just wanted to give you a dirty inning for you to listen to during your travels. If you're a Phillies fan making your way around the Delaware Valley, or just driving in the tri-state area to go see your relatives, we wanted you to have some company on the road, because obviously you can't go 2 seconds without Phillies media consumption.
It's important. Especially with such an exciting team.
Especially with so much going on. We're going to take you back to 1952 in this episode. Everyone's favorite era of Phillies baseball. June 4th, 1952, actually. And Philadelphia was tuning into some of its beloved sports at the time.
Uh-huh.
Maybe you've heard these Philadelphia people. They like their sports.
Oh, can I take a pause to say, if you like sports, why don't you go check out A Phillies Odyssey by our friend at WIBR, Where is Ben Rivera? A lovely little book about all the Phillies' past players and not so legendary people that you may remember. If you like this show and you like this segue that Justin's setting up, you may like the book.
Yes, I was going to do this at the end of the episode.
Well, that's kind of cheap, isn't it?
With a much more natural transition and plug. But yeah,
I'm wondering who you think listens to the end of our episodes.
Let's just jump right in the middle of the sentence I was speaking.
Yep,
and
let's
throw
do it.
But Dave certainly has earned it. Hey, until there's an actual literal dirty inning book, this is the spiritual continuer of this
yes.
podcast in book form.
100%.
So
yes.
If you like the dirty inning, you'll love A Phillies Odyssey by Dave Reuter.
Like the dirty inning, what the hell is wrong with you?
It's a gallery of forgotten Phillies and stuff that nobody, you know, it fits our very niche audience here. But also, Dave's just an entertaining storyteller and writer, so I think it's got broad appeal as well. So
yeah,
definitely find that.
Would like it.
Find that and give it a read. Maybe while you're listening to this podcast and driving your family, you simultaneously just crack open a book. You know, and just have a good time on the road this holiday season. People are typically very calm and rational behind the wheel around this time of year. So
people love when you crack open a book while you're driving. look and they say, "What a smart fellow."
Look, if you almost T-bone somebody out there and you look up and that guy's reading this book, you're going to be upset you weren't also reading that book. There's just a lot of jealousy. You're going to have book envy.
Just give him a little wink. Yeah. Say thanks for listening to thanks for reading good stuff.
Hey, that's a good looking book you got there. Wish I had one of them too. If you have a wink powerful and eloquent enough that to express that very specific sentiment non-verbally.
Yes.
All right. Well, now that the plug section is over? Is there more?
No more plugs. I have nothing.
I mean, Trev's got he's got a whole other book.
We plugged that last episode.
Okay, he's got a whole other podcast. Maybe you want
to. We do not need to plug my podcast. No.
Okay.
No, this is good. This is good. I think we did it.
Great.
I think we got it.
All right. Well, this is, of course, the Dirty Inning, where we talk about the dumbest, funniest, and most obscure innings in Philadelphia Phillies history. So that explains why we were just talking about all that other unrelated stuff for the first few minutes. But yeah, like I said, we're giving you some road material this year for your Thanksgiving travels. Just getting one last podcast in before the Good Fight crew takes a brief autumn break with everybody else from the podcasts this weekend. Unless, of course, you know, something crazy happens, then I guess John and I and Liz will get on cups with wires attached to them from the windows.
Wuxtree!
different houses across state lines, and we're just like, oh, Cash Harbor. That high quality you've come to expect from our shows.
What big move do you think they could even make? I guess it would be a trade.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm really talking myself into a Brian Reynolds situation. Yeah, we talked about this on Hitting Season. If they're going to trade for anybody, I'd want it to be him specifically. You know, there's a couple of center fielders out there, I know, but he's the one whose only downside is what you'd have to give up to get him. And once you get over that, he's just a fully all-dimension player who's among the best in the league at, you know, playing center field.
It worked for JT Realmuto.
And he's only 27. You know, he's got two very good years of baseball under his belt at the major league level. And he's got like tons of team control still in front of him. I mean, you're gonna be giving up one of your best people, if not, and more. But I think that's what the Phillies should do right now. Frankly, like that's an area of need, and that would improve them. It would be like, did you just make the Realmuto comparison? Because
yeah,
you'd be zooming from like last to one of the top five at least at that position in the National League.
Yeah.
So, yeah,
I think that makes a ton of sense. Yeah, absolutely.
All right. I think I talked Trev into that. So
I really wasn't planning. I was very much against it at first.
Brian Reynolds, I say no. 30 seconds later, you've sold me on it, sir, and I'd like to subscribe to your newsletter. Well, today that newsletter is about the 1952 Phillies. June 4th, 1952, like I said, the city of Philadelphia was tuning into some of its beloved sports, or at least they would have been if the event in question hadn't been blacked out. I bet you thought I meant the Phillies and Major League Baseball and all that, but no, that's silly. Again, it's 1952. That's, of course, that's nothing at this point. The Phillies were also an unthrilling 18-22 at this point in the season. They were about to play the Reds at Crosley Field in Cincinnati. No, I'm talking about the other realm in which Cincinnati and Philadelphia would clash on this day, sort of. In the heavyweight boxing title match between Ezzard Charles, who was trying to become the first boxer to regain the heavyweight title after losing it, and Arnold Cream, better known as Jersey Joe Walcott, a Jersey boy, you might have guessed. Born in Pennsauken Township, he'd eventually retire from boxing and become the first black sheriff of Camden County.
Wow, good for him.
It reminded me of Mo Sislak listing all of his boxing nicknames. And then the guy's name was his name is Arnold, but his boxing name is Jersey Joe. I don't know.
Kid Gorgeous.
I mean,
kid
maybe
presentable. Finally, Kid Mo.
Walcott was one of the few champs to be considered the underdog in his title defense match. Charles was 8 years younger, and he had beaten Walcott twice before on points. But in their last meeting, Walcott had said goodnight to him with his consciousness-stealing left hook. Meanwhile, Walcott hadn't fought since he knocked out Charles last summer. So maybe people in Philly were rooting for him in that casual way where we accept places in South Jersey or out in the suburbs or in the Northeast when it suits us and needlessly insult them all the other times. But
you're unnoticed, Cherry Hill.
That's right. This podcast doesn't hold back. Hashtag no filter. But the fight was taking place in Philadelphia, which has a lot to do with our interest in it. But not that much interest, given that the fight would not be aired on television in Philadelphia.
Ah.
But you know what was?
What?
The Philco Television Playhouse, an anthology storytelling series.
Oh, you found another crazy show.
They put together a little comedy drama starring your Philadelphia Phillies, Trev. At least it used their names, but I believe the Phillies players in the movie were played by actors, but they used the real players' names.
What?
Yeah, this was interesting. So what story did they tell, you ask?
Oh, I'm sure a very good one.
Oh, the most 1950s story you've ever heard of at the intersection of sports and gender.
Ooh, okay, great.
This is from the Inquirer. Philco, what was it called? Philco Television Playhouse tried a topical little comedy drama titled A Man's Game and had a lot of fun with the Phillies. The play was about a lady pitcher who was so terrific that Eddie Sawyer signed her to play on the team. Her husband got tired of being one of the girls with the players' wives down in the Florida training camp and asserted himself by going back to the farm. Anyway, the Phillies were set to win 40 games with this wonderful lady pitcher, but on opening day, it turned out she was going to have a baby, and the deal was off.
God. Good Lord. That's humiliating.
It played nicely, and the gimmick of using real names of real players mixed in with the fiction helped make the hour an enjoyable one. Strikes us that this was a good comedy technique that could bear repetition.
No, absolutely not.
What a ridiculous bit of fiction this was. A woman playing baseball for the Phillies. The Phillies would never be the first team to adopt a change like that. They would sit there watching other teams undergo these processes, harass and hurl insults at them for doing so, and then eventually adopt the new normal when forced to by outside pressures, like a normal team.
The 1956 film also just included, there's nothing in the rules that says a woman can't play baseball.
Ain't no rules that says a woman can't play baseball. Oh, wait, she's pregnant. Get out.
Ooh, you'll infect the clubhouse.
Like what is that?
It's a horrible film.
I like to think women
must have loved living in the 50s. It must have been cool.
The writers just all sitting around going like, all right, well, obviously she can't be a baseball player. So how do we get her out of there in like a nice way? And it's like, oh, right. She's having a baby. The end.
Congratulations.
Oh, maybe she can come back when the baby is born. No. Who's going to raise that baby? Her husband? He works on a farm. 50s are great.
I'm glad they introduced the, like, they like made it so that the husband was just like a little impoverished.
Yeah, I wonder,
like,
if
mostly he just got sick of hanging out with other ladies.
I wonder if they framed it like he was in the wrong for getting frustrated and leaving, and like,
no,
they made up, or if they just played it like, no, he was pissed because who wouldn't be pissed, and then he left, and then, you know, they had a baby, so everything was fine.
I'd be legitimately stunned if they framed it as he was in the wrong.
Yeah,
it would be shocking to me.
So would I. Yeah. Well, you certainly didn't have to look far for casual sexism in 1952, Trev.
What about casual sex?
The Inquirer mentioned a recent competition held by Temple University for aspiring sports journalists who were currently in grade school. The blurb seems pretty tickled by the idea of there being a few what they call lasses there to interview Eagles coach Greasy Neal and have their interviewing and writing skills judged. So who won it? Some bright boy in the front row? The paper asked. The winner was Miss Joan McDermott from the Academy of the Sisters of Mercy in Gwynedd Valley, PA. I don't know where you are or if you kept with it, Joan, but I hope you spent the next few decades making authors like that choke on their coffee.
Oh, I hope so, too. I fear that it didn't happen, but I hope it did.
And speaking of society, temperance leagues across the nation were recoiling in fear. At the notion of a new menace.
God, what a pro.
A new menace crackling across their airwaves like the hot coals of hell. A bunch of them went to a bunch of temperance leagues, that is, went to a House subcommittee and yelled how there needed to be a barrier between this new medium of television commercials and the innocent audience having their souls sucked out of their heads through the screens. Mm-hmm. Yes, with this new avenue for Satan to reach our children, it was time to defeat him the same way Jesus did in the Bible, with legislation. In particular, these temperance groups had a problem with beer commercials.
Ah, well.
In fact, it was a certain beer commercial in which a man held a beer, sipped it noisily, licked his lips, and pronounced that the beer was good. The groups felt that the ad was, quote, deceptive and false advertising on the merits of alcohol, to which I say, no, it wasn't. Like, it wasn't. So
that's actually how alcohol kind of works. It's take a sip and you go, finally,
a feeling.
I had some alcohol. This is great.
I really like the idea of hating a product so much you call any claim that it's good false advertising and feel so strongly about your opinion that you take it to a House subcommittee. The leader of one of these temperance leagues was named C.S. Longacre, which I might steal for a novel about a horse.
No, you should.
About like a horse wearing glasses who is a villain. And a woman ran through a woman talking to this subcommittee, she ran through a full day of television that she watched for research, pointing out her problems with each thing that happened on screen.
Got a lot of problems with you people.
Beginning with a rather good play in the early afternoon, she said, the programs ran through a cycle of westerns, then puppet shows, then, quote, very low necklines.
Uh-huh,
then,
uh-huh.
Then,
excellent.
Then Groucho Marx.
Oh,
then,
okay. Well, I'm sure she had no problem with that, right?
Then T-Men chasing jewel robbers.
T-Men.
In between shows, Miss Smart said, there was that man with the beer glass. So he was basically a horror movie villain at this point. The man with the beer glass. I saw the man with the beer glass last night. He looked really satisfied, like he'd just gotten away with something. And I knew he had just sipped a beer, the unthinkable act of a hellion straight off the streets, right into my living room, Trev.
Such a fantastic, like, Hitchcockian villain, the man with the beer glass.
Like, yeah.
I was looking out the window and I saw a man with a beer glass.
Right, it's Rear Window, but he just sees a guy like just chilling, just drinking a beer out of it.
This is a dud.
Members of their church, Longacre said, wanted to buy televisions but couldn't out of fear of what they'd be exposed to. A state representative countered by saying this was all everyone's personal responsibility and they should
state
just...
State representative countered by saying, what the hell are you talking about?
They should just all handle their own shit. And more literally saying that, and he did say this, if parents had a problem with what their children were seeing on TV, they could handle it by throwing the damn thing out the window.
Oh, that guy rules. I don't care what his political... This is the one time I'll reach across the aisle. I don't care if he's like... I don't care if it was Strom Thurmond. That was a good move right there.
Might have been Strom.
It could have been. We all have to accept that possibility.
The American people had been let off the leash. In the matter of television, they were on their own, unless the government wanted to bust in with a warning about a tornado or an incoming missile or something. We were busting out, Trev. Americans had 52 Woo. Million cars on the road, burning 38 million gallons of gasoline a year. We were out and about.
Ooh, the city just of killing it. The environment.
Yeah. The city of Philadelphia was working a few things out all on its own as well. There was this pesky age limit at the time set on work in heavy labor industries.
The liberals are at it again.
Cowards. These cowards won't put their children into a giant warehouse full of dangerously unmonitored factory machines. This damn city, under rules even the paper casually called arbitrary, had a 45-year limit on workers. As was commonly the case at this time, a series of advocacy groups would take turns addressing a committee, including the 45 Plus League of Philadelphia.
I love the 45 Plus League.
So what I believe this is like, they're just setting limits on the age of workers in these heavy labor industries just to keep it, you know, a more, I guess, youthful, quote unquote, crowd. But yeah, I mean, did everybody have a league back then?
Yeah. Well, that's all you did. You had to join a league. I mean, like, what else are you going to do at night? Except like you could join a league or you could become a shiftless drunk. Those were your options.
And hey, with all these tantalizing beer commercials on the airwaves, why not?
Thinking I'm not going to join a league this year. Did you see another commercial?
I've been feeling rather shiftless these past few evenings. Could somebody hand me a beer? Well, we all know the scared people joined leagues. Older folks didn't deserve to be shipped off to some vacation home and whittle away their remaining years listening to the soft crash of waves on the beach. They wanted to have their various limbs ripped off by raucous, angry industrial machinery and die screaming on the floor of a factory, surrounded by gape-mouthed coworkers whose sympathy only went as far as, "I'm glad that isn't me." So, yeah, hopefully that's the right side of history, the 45-plus league, fighting to keep people who've been working all their lives keep working for the rest of their lives.
I really like the 45-plus league a lot. It's really stupid. It sounds like something out of a Thomas Pynchon novel. It doesn't make any sense to me at all.
The Philadelphia Gas Works was being sued by each of the three individual members of a family whose house was damaged in an explosion. The dean of Bryn Mawr College felt it was a sign of calamitous decline that the German language was no longer a popular or acceptable area of study since the First World War. And on National Secretary's Day in Philadelphia, James R. George wrote the following in the Inquirer. "Today is National Secretary's Day in Philadelphia, as in most of the rest of the country. And in celebration of the event, guess what we learned from the National Secretary's Week Council?" Because
oh my God,
it's gotta be one.
Why is that beer is refreshing?
What did we learn from the National Secretary's Week Council in New York? That secretaries are pleasant and prettier than they used to be? Of course not. We learned that statistics have been compiled showing that the average American secretary is taller, has bigger feet, lives longer and marries earlier than secretaries did 50 years ago.
Oh, nothing can stay good.
Why can't we go back to the good old days of 1902? Well, I gotta say, we were nailing it.
We were killing it back then.
When secretaries had tiny little feet, barely visible to the human eye like they were supposed to.
Eatsy beatsy peepers. And they'd marry me and not their husbands.
Like, what the hell? What the hell is that? That is such a bizarre...
I'm going to tell you what it is. Hilarious.
You want to hope the guy was like a satirist or something, but at the end of the day, he was...
He was not.
Probably just a dickhead. And the people of Philadelphia were furious with the police at this point in June 1952.
Yeah, get them.
Either they weren't doing enough to stop crimes, or they were standing in the wrong place to prevent them. This is two letters right next to each other in the letters to the editor section of the June 4th, 1952 edition of the Philadelphia Inquirer.
Okay.
This one's called Living in Fear. Yeah, coming in hot to the editor of the Inquirer. "Businessmen, householders, teenagers today are living in fear that they may be the next victims of hold-up men, burglars, purse snatchers, or criminal attackers. This menace is becoming greater now that these criminals are in action in daylight as well as darkness. Mayor Clark and Police Commissioner Gibbons must take some drastic measures. This menace should and must be cleaned up pronto. The city of Philadelphia must be made safe from criminals. Judges and magistrates must also cooperate by showing no mercy to these criminals when brought before them."
No mercy. I'll kill you.
"For the crime of I didn't even read it, you are sentenced to I'll kill you." That should put that man at ease. And then the other letter is called "Are Cops Wasted Here?" Which every time I read it, I'm just like, is this a question about all the cops
being drunk?
Being drunk all the time.
All these cops just smiling at the camera and just saying, ah. When they enjoy their beer.
I mean, I don't know. Maybe they are. Who knows?
Why this not? Yeah.
Beer is it sounds very satisfying based on the subliminal messaging I received through my television. Also, hail Satan. The letter reads, "To the editor of the Inquirer, with all the crime in this city at the present time and the police department short of men, Why do recreation centers have young, able-bodied policemen stationed there just hanging around a few hours a day with nothing to do when they could be out on a beat combating crime? If it is necessary to have an officer at these places, why not place an older and less active man there?
Or have like myself.
Have the officer on the beat and the red car make a check at regular intervals. And the letter is signed, Disgusted.
Wow. That's strong, man. That's like, that's pretty extreme for like a letter just about like whether or not we should station younger officers at like YMCAs, like signed Disgusted. It's pretty exciting.
Yeah. I like the very particular issue, which, you know, hey, that's what the letters to the editor page is for, you know, but I love that he had this very specific issue.
Yeah, for sure.
Of not just like the crime in this city is out of control, but like I passed a community center and there was a cop just standing there, and
what's this guy up to?
I mean, if as we all know, when a cop clocks into his shift, he is stopping crime the entire time, like entirely. He's just stopping bank robberies, jumping from car to car. Well, hey, what about those Phillies we love so much?
Oh, I love that team.
We did say this was a Phillies podcast.
Did
so,
we? That was a weird lie, but okay.
Why don't we take a little break here, and when we come back, we'll get into what the Phillies were actually doing on June 4th, 1952, because, hey, it is a Phillies podcast, after
what?
All.
Why do you keep saying that?
Well, Trev, like I was saying, hey, just what were those Philadelphia Phillies up to on June 4th, 1952?
You better not say this is a Phillies podcast again.
Because we, a Phillies podcast,
no!
would probably want to discuss that. Those old wastrels, profligates, and spendthrifts, what were those dumb little boys getting up to anyway, those Philadelphia Phillies of ours?
Justin, when you listen to this podcast, please understand that Justin does not know anything about the Philadelphia Phillies, and to him, it is all just a Little Rascals cartoon.
What were those scallywags getting up to as they scampered around town with their slick-backed hair, hopping on and off of trolleys, and do-gooding when it suited them, but playing dice in the alley when
remember
that
suited
them as well?
The famous catcher on the Phillies put a potato in that guy's tailpipe? That was so funny.
Well, the Phillies were losing 10-8 to the Reds in Cincinnati in a game
where
they did a dirty inning to the Reds, only for the Reds to come back and dirty inning them.
Uh-oh.
That's right, Trev. It's a dirty inning inside a dirty inning, as I alluded to earlier.
I hate it. Oh, no.
And that's our Thanksgiving tie-in this year. You know,
makes me so uncomfortable.
The best kind of meat has a different meat inside of it. And because we as a society are lazy and we don't just hunt animals that have recently eaten another animal, we instead buy two dead animals and shove one inside of the other. And I frankly find that deplorable, but here we are.
Do you?
What kind of meat do you eat on Thanksgiving, Tim?
On Thanksgiving? I actually don't eat turducken, in fairness.
Oh, neither. I've actually never had it, I don't think.
I've had it once. Someone bought it at Costco. Our friend Sean bought it at Costco, and we had it for Thanksgiving one time. It was all right. It was mostly dry.
Do you like duck? I actually really like duck.
I do like duck a lot. I really do. I don't have duck a lot at Thanksgiving. That seems like a really good solution, though, for the fact that I don't really like turkey that much. I actually, you know what? I made a turkey one time that I really did enjoy. I like turkey when I make it because I can sort of like take as much time as I want with it. But I don't know. I'm not super excited about a lot of meats at Thanksgiving. I'm a sides man.
Okay, I hear you. I'm both. I wouldn't say I can choose a side in this category.
Hey, all right.
But yeah, good. The best Thanksgivings are when it's a grilled turkey, a smoked turkey.
Very fan nice. Of
that. Like I do like I don't know. I mean, some years I've definitely been like, oh yeah, dark meat is where it's at. But light meat also, you know, I have a preference. But honestly, Liz is always talking about the big Italian Thanksgiving her family throws together. And my God, I've never been. I went to my brother-in-law has his father is Italian, and I went to their holiday dinner one year, and man, that was awesome.
Italian Thanksgivings are pretty neat. They're
I want to sample that sometime because that sounds incredible.
It's like a cool idea. I remember my parents used to go to the Italian Thanksgiving that my Nana Rose would put on, and then afterwards drive to the regular Thanksgiving that my mother's parents put on. And like apparently one time they almost fell asleep and got hit by a car, or almost got hit by a car, and they were like, "We can't do this again. We're done now. This is over."
Oh my God. That is not the charming Thanksgiving anecdote. I thought it was, it had an abrupt end and near death experience.
Yeah. I think it was even like, maybe I was involved and almost died. I don't know.
I was driving the other car.
Wow. 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 Goo, goo, ga, ga. Why is this baby driving a car? Baby shouldn't be driving a car.
It's these damn police officers that don't have enough to do. Standing outside the community centers, not stopping babies from stealing cars on Thanksgiving.
Ugh. I'm sick of these police officers. Signed, disgusted.
So anyway, yeah, we're jamming a dirty inning inside of a dirty inning in this episode of the Dirty Inning. And yeah, like I said, the Phillies were losing 10-8 to the Reds. Let's start with the pitcher responsible. His name was Russ Mayer. And 2 years before, in 1950, Mayer was one of baseball's classic wackadoos. Only he was old.
Oh, boy.
He was older now, so his occasionally rage-filled antics weren't charming and fun. They were childish and unbecoming.
And horrifying.
He was, of course, 26 years old, for God's sake, and we can assume he didn't have rich parents because no one was calling him a little boy or making excuses for him, even though he was old enough to do everything in society that has an age limit. But manager Eddie Sawyer and the Phillies needed Mayer to be as good a pitcher as he was while being way less of the psycho he also was. So you know what that means.
No.
Time for a little shock treatment.
Ah, excellent. Literal shock treatment? Did they give him
I think you need to help me figure this out. This is like one of those things that somebody...
You don't know if it's a metaphor?
Some Phillies historian is going to message us and be like, that was actually a term used to describe blah, 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 blah. Or like it was often like a joke at the time or something.
What a horrible job to be a historian and demystify these wonderful metaphors.
I mean, but just listen to this. So currently, 1952, Mayer was under fire from the league because of a play where he had to cover first base. The umpire had called the runner safe. Mayer had disagreed. He'd hurled the ball at the umpire after he'd been thrown out of the game. The ball just hit the ump in the leg, but he freaked out like umpires always do when you
of course.
Hit them with the equipment.
Give him an inch and these guys will take a mile.
And then Mayer returned to the field and chested the umpire before Eddie Sawyer could lead him away.
Yeah!
For his antics...
That's why Eddie Sawyer hired that woman.
For his antics, Mayer was fined $200 and suspended for a week by NL
that's
president...
That's pretty significant amount of money for back then.
Yeah, that, and then suspended for a week by Ford Frick. The reason for the shock therapy talk was because this was not the first time Mayer had a meltdown near, at... and or on an umpire. 2 years before, in 1950, Mayer had been pitching for the Cubs when Jackie Robinson stole home and was called safe.
Oh, no. Mayer, are you going to tell me this lovable scamp is not the lovable scamp I was hoping for?
Mayer was, for some reason, extra mad about this stolen base in particular and proceeded to grab the umpire, ripping three buttons off his shirt and, quote, abraded him with language both severe and profane, read the Inquirer. According to The Integration of Baseball in Philadelphia by Christopher Threston, Mayer's nickname was Mad Monk, which sucks because it's a great nickname.
It's a wonderful nickname, and I hate that it's wasted on this guy.
Yeah, and that's the problem. But it referred to Mayer's outrageous temper, which was routinely aimed at black and Jewish players, including Jackie Robinson. His brushback pitches against the Dodgers started a lot of conflict between the clubs, and he was a big reason the Phillies earned their reputation as a dipshit racist outfit at the time.
The Mad Monk. That's so cool.
Oh, he had another nickname that Bob Carpenter gave him.
What is it?
Russell the Rednecked Reindeer.
That's pretty good.
According to Carl E. Prince in his book, Brooklyn's Dodgers, the Bums, the Burrow, and the Best of Baseball. Yeah, isn't that...
Pretty funny.
That's... That's
pretty solid burn on him.
Yeah, surprisingly sharp, I would say, for the era. For an era where, like, humor was like, I put my eyeball on, like, a telescope, and now there's a dark circle around my eyeball. Humor!
I want my nickname to be the Mad Monk. All right, you're the racist idiot. I don't know about that one.
You're the Mad Monk. Well, how racist are you? Are you extremely racist? All right, we'll call you Mad Monk. And that was Russ Mayer. In 1951, Mayer kicked a chair in anger and broke his toe. Well, they only thought he broke it. It turns out it was just severely injured.
Oh, that Jeez, same don't go crazy here, Justin.
That same type of thing happened to him in spring training in 1952 as well, when they thought he'd broken his elbow after x-rays. But it turns out the fracture they saw on the bone was merely from an earlier anger episode when he'd broken it, and there was still like a chip in there.
Mm-hmm. Chip on the shoulder.
Got a real A-list medical team at this point checking out the x-rays.
I'm glad this has been a tradition in Philadelphia for a long time.
Like looking at these x-rays.
Fantastic medical experts dealing with all of our sports stars.
You want to hold it up to the light so you can see it better? I'm the doctor here. Turn off all the lights in the entire office. I only view my x-rays in the pitch darkness. Because I'm a professional. When Mayer was drafted into the Army, he got hurt, but not in the way you'd think. He was pitching in an exhibition game as a member of the service.
Trying to think of the way I think. I guess I would assume in action. But
right. That's what I'm saying. And instead of that, he was pitching in a baseball game. He mm-hmm. threw a single pitch in the game and then collapsed because his appendix had ruptured.
That'll happen.
This guy, he had some health issues along the way. For those not in the know, going back to the shock treatment thing, shock treatment is defined by Merriam-Webster as the treatment of mental illness by the artificial induction of coma or convulsions through use of drugs or electric current. Uh-huh. So I'm putting that there because then John Webster wrote in the Inquirer, one of Eddie Sawyer's most pressing duties in his management of the Phillies must consist of the further calming down of his explosive right-hander, Russ Mayer. Thus, the burly pilot's task should have been aided no little yesterday with shock treatment from another source. NL President Ford Frick's $200 fine and 7-day set-down for the unstable pitcher's demonstration against umpire Al Barlick at Scheib Park on Sunday. The Phillies admire the young man's fiery competitive spirit. They wouldn't change him, completely. Yet there's a point where competitive spirit ends and where Russ reaches the boiling point of instability. It's happened with him before, but there is no logical reason why it should happen again.
I have to assume they're not actually giving him shock therapy.
I would assume that as well.
I think the idea there is, like, they're saying he's nuts, so he should get shock therapy, but also that the shock therapy is Ford Frick giving him a fine.
Right, and he's saying he would be shocked by how severe the fine is.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
Yeah. So, Russ Mayer, guy you'd probably see called a firebrand or a temperamental in the modern game. His past is likely referred to as complicated. Mayer would play 13 years in the majors for 6 different teams. The Phillies, Cubs, Browns, Reds, A's, and Red Sox. And his current career ERA was 3.99. He snuck just under that 4 threshold. Ugh. Statistical milestones include having the best home runs per nine in the league in 1952 with 0.4. He threw the most wild pitches in baseball in 1951 with 9. And in 1949, he got 8 MVP voting points. He had like a 3.08 ERA in 213 innings that year. In the book 1954: A Baseball Season, by James Kreese, it is revealed
not even a baseball story, it's a baseball season.
We learned that Brooklyn's Russ Mayer, considered among baseball's best dressers, admitted to owning 60 to 70 suits, 200 sports shirts, 50 pairs of slacks, 40 pairs of shoes and 150 neckties. But
that's
not
a lot of shirts.
But not sure how many dress shirts. He also said he never remembers wearing a hat and does not own one. Interesting that a man of
who plays baseball,
fashionable, yeah, fashionable, and whose job is wearing a hat can't remember wearing a hat. But also, Trev, how many ties do you own currently?
I'm going to put it conservatively at like a 10.
Yeah, I was like, I think less than 20.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Like more than 10, less than 20. I'd say I'd go with that.
I don't own a lot. Not as much as this guy.
We've certainly all been working from our homes for the past 2 years as well.
What? Why?
So formal.
What have you been up to?
Formal attire has, yeah. In 1952, Mayer was 28 and he had his reputation. In the other dugout across from the Phillies on the Cincinnati Reds side was Frank Hiller for the Reds. And he had a reputation too.
Was it for being kind?
In 1951, the year Mayer had led the league in wild pitches with 9, Hiller had led the league in hit batsmen, also with 9.
Ooh, okay.
So that's right. Not only did two of the biggest cases of command issues show up for this game to pitch to the each respective offense, but the two biggest cases of command issues had shown up.
I like these guys' stuff. I'm excited to see what they can make of themselves.
Hiller was a twin. Biologically,
he didn't play for the Minnesota Twins because they didn't exist. They were still the Washington Senators.
And he was big into music. He was a former Glee Club president and clarinet player, according to Saber. He never lost a game as a pitcher in high school, and he's the only player from his school to go to the major leagues. Seemingly the antithesis of Mayer. In 1943, Phillies manager Bucky Harris said about Hiller, "I like the boy because he has intestinal fortitude. The most important thing for a pitcher to have next to a steel arm."
An arm that never breaks.
This guy's like out in his garage late at night. "I'm trying. I won't come to bed. I'm building the perfect pitcher out of refuse from the local junkyard." "Don't you understand? It needs a heart." In the minors, after being signed by the Yankees, however, Hiller suffered a neuroma of the ulnar nerve, a condition brought on by a bruised muscle which produced a jabbing shock with every pitch. So there's shock treatment again. With a monkey stabbing him in the back, Hiller set about his career, reaching the big leagues, going back down, pitching well, struggling, being traded, junked his knee, broke his nose. He was advised to retire by a nerve specialist and received a low ball.
What do they know?
Received a low ball. "I go by the community center every day, and one of these nerve specialists is just sitting there not diagnosing anyone with career-ending issues. And I ask you, why?" And then Hiller received a low ball offer from a Pacific Coast League team to extend his career briefly before retiring. But in 1952, after a brief, wild opener, he strung together 3 complete games, earning only 3 runs in 27 innings. Then, over the course of the year, Hiller started walking more batters, giving up more home runs, and in August, he collided at first base with Richie Ashburn and got that broken nose I mentioned earlier.
Not good.
But today, on June 4th, 1952, Mayer and Hiller... I want you to know, as I'm reading my notes, the name Hiller looks like Hitler a lot.
Ah, great.
And I keep almost saying it, but I don't. So I should get props for that.
I'm impressed with you. That's good. It's very tempting and easy and fun to say Hitler. And you didn't do it.
Mayer and Hiller squared off to see who could stand out there on the mound and keep their balance long enough to win the game. It turns out it was neither of them.
A
man named Fred Smith got the win in this one on June 4th, 1952.
It's like a completely fake person. I'm glad he won.
The losing pitcher was Ken Heitzelman, who, like Russ Meyer on the Phillies side, had gotten MVP votes in 1949 as well, including a first place vote.
Wow. Okay.
That was a year when 30 guys got MVP points.
Boy, good for him.
Seems like a lot, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, four. How many guys? Four?
30.
Jesus. 30 guys got like four.
They got MVP voting points.
Oh, I thought you said it first for first place.
No. Not all. Ken Heitzelman got a first place vote.
Which is impressive. Honestly.
Just one. Yeah. But just the one. And then like 30 guys got points to appear on the MVP voting
list. That's kind of crazy. Can you imagine even getting to like, I mean, obviously they have their weirdo like top three thing now, which is boring. But like, can you imagine having, I don't know, like even 7 guys that people were like, yeah, these guys definitely deserve first place votes?
No.
I feel like Brandon Crawford getting the votes recently has been like, okay, come on, guys. Don't be stupid.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
Be normal.
I'm sure there's been plenty of examples of this over the past 10 years and throughout all of baseball. But this year in particular, I don't know why. Maybe because I was paying a little more attention, given that there was a Philly involved in the Cy Young Award and there was a Philly involved and then eventually winning the MVP Award. But homerism is alive and
good
well
gravy.
Among yeah. these writers who are like, I'm objective, I'm not a fan, but like they definitely are fans, especially the San Francisco chapter. Like,
oh, Susan Slusser, yeah, just like, didn't she put Harper fifth?
Yeah, she's the one who put
very
him
funny
very far, and it was a Cincinnati writer who put Wheeler fifth. Like, it was just some ridiculous shit. She had Tyler O'Neill third on her MVP ballot.
Listen, he's my MVP pick in my league where I hit myself in the head several times with a shovel and then make picks.
You're our most valuable self-inflicted head wound candidate, Trev.
Really?
I'm just kidding. We don't talk about you. All right. So, yeah, like I said, that seems like a lot of guys getting MVP points. Also a lot were the amount of runs scored by the Reds off. When we get an award, it's going to be for best transition.
Our transitions are just, honestly, it's kind of gross how good we are at transition.
Also a lot were the amount of runs scored by the Reds off Russ Meyer in the bottom of the inning.
Oh, he did it.
Yeah, I know I said Russ Meyer a paragraph ago. I don't know why I did that. I switch pronunciations and names in these episodes, as some people have definitely noticed. Anyway, Russ Meyer in the bottom of the second. In his Reds debut, Willard Marshall led off the inning for Cincinnati with a double. Wally Westlake and Joe Rossi walked and singled to load the bases with no outs. The Phillies had the Reds right where they wanted them, assuming their intention was to be humiliated. Roy McMillan entered the fray, swatting a single to Dell Anis in left that scored a run. When the throw came in to Phillies catcher Smokey Burgess, it went right through him.
Actually, like in a cartoon?
Yeah, like it was a ghost.
Left a hole in him? Whoa.
The backstop was charged by both base runners coming in to score, and also with an error on the play. Meyer got two more batters, allowing one to knock in another run with a single before getting the first out of the inning on a flyout by opposing pitcher Frank Hiller. Because Eddie Sawyer couldn't swap out his whole team at this point,
I bet he wanted to.
He went out and pulled Meyer out of the game and replaced him with Steve Rydzik. Somehow, things did not improve.
Huh.
With a base runner inherited from Meyer and one out, Rydzik allowed a single and a 3-run home run to Grady Hatton. Fortunately, this was the last 3-run play of the inning for the Reds.
That seems like a very light, fortunately. The last 3-run play of the inning is, that's a real, besides that, how was the play, Mrs. Lincoln?
A super milestone.
Yeah.
And the Phillies could return to the dugout knowing they'd tried their whateverest. So our Phils are down 7-1 now and would be down 8-1 after Willard Marshall would again.
Oh, it's our Phils now, is it?
They would again get to them with a solo shot a few innings later. It wasn't until the top of the sixth on June 4th, 1952, that the Phillies would do the unthinkable and make things interesting. In the sixth, Hiller gave up a single, a walk, and an infield hit to load the bases with no outs. Granny Hamner came up, and he singled in 2 runs. Eddie Watkins walked to reload the bases. Phil Hogstad replaced Hiller on the mound, a man who had been claimed off waivers by the Reds and would appear in only 9 games for them. Near the end of his career, he had originally signed with the Dodgers, and Branch Rickey had promoted him to the big club for its World Series run in 1946.
Oh, okay. Good for him.
But because Rickey let Hogstad pitch one last game in the minors, he wound up being one day too late
for,
for big league roster eligibility, and he missed his chance to pitch in the World Series.
Rough.
Now, he was with the team the following year, this Reds relief pitcher. He was with the Dodgers again in 1947 when they went back to the World Series, but he never left the bench, according to his Sabre biography.
Man, that sucks.
Talk about a guy who twice got tantalizingly close to the World Series and twice did not get to play in it.
Guess what? You're on the roster. Ooh, messed up. You're not on the roster.
You made it, but I don't like how your face looks, so you're not getting in the game. Every Thanks, day Skip. I drive by the community center and you're standing out there being all shiftless and drunk, and I don't like it.
Enjoying a beer on my watch.
Skip, that's
Brad Rickey.
Skip, that's not me.
That's a commercial you saw.
What are you talking about? Every time I drive down the street, all the people have your face. That's you out there everywhere. You can see the arm was going as Hogstad gave up a wild pitch and two walks before leaving the game. Both the wild pitch and one of the walks resulted in the Phillies scoring a run, making it a now 8-4 game.
Tantalizing.
Bud Byerly was next out of the Reds' bullpen, another man who was not long for the Reds' roster. Clearly, Cincinnati was just throwing bodies at the problem.
Better than the Phillies in some ways, I guess.
Byerly had two shitty outings before this one, allowing 5 and 6 earned runs, respectively. Appropriately, his last major league inning would be a hitless one against the Phillies in 1960. I feel like a lot of pitchers can say that from this era.
Yeah. At least I got to go out against the Phillies.
Boy, I never had a better season than that season I started like 8 games against the Phillies. Sure, nothing to read into there.
That was a little strange, but it's probably normal, I guess.
Oh, no, I was acquired by the Phillies? Son of a...
Oh, God.
Well, fortunately for the Reds, Byerly got Connie Ryan to strike out, but two singles and a sack fly later, Cincinnati once more went to the bullpen for the fourth pitcher of the inning, Frank Smith, who induced a ground out to end the Phillies' rally.
That sucks.
Which inning was dirtier, do you think? Both saw the batting team score 7 runs. Both changed the story of the game dramatically.
I gotta say the last inning was dirtier because it involved more careers ending.
I'm gonna say the last one because that's the one I remember.
No, it's because of the careers ending. I gave you a reason.
Regardless, the Phillies had evened the score at 8-8 after being down 8-1, which was no small feat. And I feel like especially no small feat given the era they were playing in. Where
because of all their big feet.
You don't just score. The Phillies used their big, swift feet to to run down the baseline. And reach base. Just given the era, scoring 7 runs in an inning was sorcery at this point. And the
correct, yes.
They had 2 innings like that in this game. And, you know, once you go up by that amount, it's like, okay, so it's a rout. And then the Phillies came back and they tied it up. I mean, that's no small feat.
That's not bad, yeah. Honestly, I think it's cool that they tied it up. Maybe that's another reason that the last inning is a problem for me, because it's like, you tied it up and then everyone just like kind of screwed up and you still lost.
That's actually a big contributor considering that they do lose the game. It does. Yeah.
I always feel bad though. There's like a tiny part of me that, I mean, I love the story, but it always like, there's a sort of like melancholic part to me when it's like, and that was the last inning he'd ever pitched before falling off the history register forever. He just goes and works and like, I don't know, like Kenosha or something.
Okay. I was a promising young pitcher until this day in which he was so humiliated by the Cleveland Spiders that they cut him from the team. And what do you know, the next day working on his father's farm, he was kicked in the head by a horse and died instantly.
The dirty inning.
You're like, just, is baseball a nightmare?
Oh, yes. No. If this show's taught me anything.
Oh, my, yes. But like I said, then of course, yeah, after the 7-run rally in which the Phillies tied it back up at 8-8, the Reds did score 2 runs in the 8th on a single and a sack fly.
Ah.
And the whole 7-run rally the Phillies put together was for nothing. I won't say this was the game that drove Eddie Sawyer insane, the Phillies manager at the time, but I will assert that it didn't help. When the Phillies manager did resign later that month, he said it was something he'd been considering for a long time, and even if the team had been winning in 1952, it wasn't enticing enough of a position that he wouldn't have quit the following year anyway. So Sawyer had tried his hardest to whip these boys into shape at spring training that year, issuing an austerity mandate team-wide. No wives, no automobiles, no golf, no gambling,
wives.
No swimming, and a strict curfew is the order of the day at the camp.
All right, you bums. Your wives can't come to camp.
I'm taking away all your favorite stuff. Your wives, oh man. Your golf, oh man. Your gambling, oh man. Your automobiles. Well, I mean, that's okay. I mean, no, you're swimming. Well, I wasn't going to go swimming, but a strict curfew. Well, if I'm not doing any of that other stuff, then why would... Okay, never mind. In response to these draconian rules, the Phillies were 7 games under 500 by the time Sawyer threw in the towel. Games like the one on June 4th probably came to mind, a day on which the Phillies managed to give their best and take advantage of some good luck and bad defense and scrap together an improbable one-inning comeback only for the win to once again slip through their fingers. And you know what? After a loss like that, I'd start thinking about quitting too.
Quitting time.
Oh, you know what? This sucks.
I hate this.
I hate this. I'm out. Yeah.
Why did I decide to manage baseball again? The current salary is 75 cents per game. No, just in general.
I see. And I don't know anything about baseball as I'm signing this contract. Are the Phillies a good team?
Oh, yes.
Considered
the best in all of baseball.
I mean, they have uniforms and gloves. I mean, they're the real deal. it's definitely a team out there when they go out there. So, did you sign it yet?
I don't want to say that we're not being honest with you, because we are, but we're lying to you, and yeah. We would like you to...
Clock's always ticking, and I mean, the last manager got kicked in kicked in the head by a horse.
Now, I don't want to say that could be you, because you don't want to get your hopes up, but...
I don't want to get your hopes up, but our last 4 managers have been kicked in the head by a horse, but not the same horse.
Philadelphia experiencing an epidemic of violent horses.
Well, here's hoping you, the listener, experience a Thanksgiving with the amount of meat inside of other meat that you want to experience, whether that's 6 yeah. layers of meat or no layers of meat.
I hope you have relatively few horse-related accidents.
Yes, I hope the team you like doesn't lose in a humiliating fashion. I hope the feet of the people you encounter are of the right size, whatever size that is. Who the hell knows? Apparently there was a time in society where we had a foot size that was acceptable. You know, those days are over.
And it was listen, were we better for it? Absolutely.
We're a better society today, now that that doesn't factor into our decision making, I would say.
No. Just kidding. We are.
But that'll do it for this episode of The Dirty Inning. Stay tuned for the coming month. We'll do, as we always do, a Dirty Inning Hit and Run, a smaller episode of The Dirty
Inning.
Always fun. Where we either talk about something from our most recent episode of this podcast or something, you know, a little more of the moment. And I think we're going to do something on Doug Jones, who passed away yesterday.
Oh, yeah. Really sad. Passing away from COVID. Really neat pitcher, too.
Yeah, he maybe
the coolest baseball card of all time.
He pitched very briefly for the Phillies. He was only there in 1994, but that was a time where I was still I was very excited about baseball and very excited about the Phillies, given that obviously 1993 had only been the season before, and Doug Jones was around, so I was aware of him. And I know the subsection of Phillies baseball that. Baseball fans that we do this podcast for, I'm sure has an attachment to him as well. So we're going to do something for Doug Jones over on the Patreon. But yeah, as always, thanks for listening to The Dirty Inning. We love putting these episodes together, and we love that you love to listen to them. Don't forget to subscribe, rate, and download all your favorite podcasts that are part of the Good Fight podcast family, including Hittin' Season with John Stolness, Continued Success with myself and Liz Rocher, and, of course, this podcast, The Dirty Inning. In the next month, we will have more episodes of Absolutely Hammered over on the Patreon at Wells. So for $5 a month, you can get access to all kinds of bonus Phillies content. And as the hot stove heats up, and more things happen, and then there's a labor dispute and nothing happens for a while, you're going to need Phillies content to get you through the desert. And we are here for you in exchange for only $5. Thanks for listening. Have a happy Thanksgiving. And we'll talk to you next time on The Dirty Inning.
Bye-bye.